The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. I thought this evening I would pick up from a topic from when I was here 2 weeks ago. I wasn't here last week, so. 2 weeks ago, I referred to a definition, that the description that the Buddha gave for the what he called the Dharma, and I'll explain more a little bit later. But he talked about the importance of seeing, being able to see the appearance of three mental qualities, states: greed, hate, and delusion, and being able to see the disappearance of those. And that there's something about seeing the arising and disappearing of these three states, these three activities of the mind, lets you see directly the Dharma. And after I finished the talk, a number of people came up to me and said, "That was all fine, the talk, thank you," something like that. But this thing about the delusion, they were really kind of, what do you mean by delusion? And how can you see delusion arise and pass? I think that some people's idea of delusion is that if you're really deluded, by definition almost, you wouldn't know it. And so how could you see the arising, the appearance and disappearance of delusion? So I thought I would talk a little bit this evening about delusion. And maybe you'll find out that I'm deluded in the process. So delusion is a very interesting topic, I think. It's an interesting definition of delusion that's given clinically, which I didn't memorize or write it down, but it's something like the persistent and stuck perception or understanding of something which is not true, and which is not shared by a lot of other people. Something like that. They're not shared by a lot of other people. It's very interesting. And I think they had to slip that in to the definition because of religion. And, there are a lot of different religious beliefs. I mean, of course, your religious beliefs are just fine, I'm sure. But there's an amazing diversity of religious beliefs out in the world, and there have been. And why, a small fraction of them just seems so bizarre to us in our particular way of seeing things, that certainly those people who believe in them must be deluded. And, they understand something which is not true, something that's made up, and they're stuck in that view, and nothing you can do to tell them differently will change their view, and this is how things are. And so we come to Buddhism, and are Buddhists also capable of being deluded? Are there beliefs that Buddhism has? They're pretty. And if you don't have to scratch deeply into Buddhism to find some pretty unusual beliefs, I would call them bizarre. Some of them. And some people are kind of, disturbed when they start seeing some of these very unusual metaphysical beliefs in Buddhism. There's a huge array of celestial kind of beings, devas, that have always been through Buddhism down through the ages. And it's, far as we could tell, the texts and the people down through the history have believed in all these things. They believe in deities that here in the West we've never heard of. And maybe they just have different deities in India. And we have different ones here, and somehow they speak different language. They speak, Sanskrit over there, and or something, and they speak English here? Is that the common language of deities in America? In France, they speak French, you know. And I can give you kind of a list of a description of a variety of strange beliefs in Buddhism. And I mention this because it seems to be the domain of religion to believe unusual things, and that often don't have proof. And some of them you're supposed to just believe because it's told, it's in the books, or it's what the tradition says. Some of them you're supposed to, some people feel like they just believe because they grew up with it, or that just seems really true to them. And I think anthropologists are kind of point out that if you take children and educate them or prepare them or raise them in a particular religious worldview, that it, those worldviews get somehow enmeshed or embedded very deeply into the structure of the way their minds and language work. And so they start seeing the world through the lens of that deeply embedded, conditioned belief system that they grew up with. It's very hard to pull it out because if you're told these belief structures from the time you're beginning to speak, it's embedded pretty deeply. And some of the beliefs that humans have believed down through the ages, I don't think any of us would, be interested in, but back at a certain time, it was really, people really believed in Zeus, and they were really concerned about the wrath of Zeus, and they were, built monuments to Zeus, and they made offerings to Zeus, and my guess is only if there's some of you here that are really into Zeus, it's very few of you, and I suspect that it was kind of, I don't know where you learned about it, but. Or the Egyptian gods. I mean, there are, I guess, some people who believe in Egyptian gods, but it's not so common anymore. And it'd be kind of unusual if someone came along here and really started talking about the Egyptian gods as if they were really there and they were speaking to them. And, if someone said the Egyptian gods are speaking to me, tell me what to do, I had a vision of an Egyptian god, that we would think there was something a little odd about them. But if someone said they had a vision of some of the more popular gods in our society, or the one of the more popular gods that currently, populate our psyches, maybe some of us would think it's unusual if we don't believe that, but there are people who believe in those particular deities, and it's taken to be quite valid or interesting or important. And maybe in 1,000, 2,000 years, society develops and people don't have those structures anymore. This is a long-winded way of saying that religions often have a variety of unusual beliefs that, you can't use it? Try another one. Out there, I see him struggling with the hearing distance. Try another one. So the batteries wear out. And there are strange ideas in Buddhism. I don't want to say Buddhism is free of it. But if you look at the teachings of the Buddha, the stranger kinds of beliefs and ideas seem to not be essential to the teaching of Buddhism. Maybe even not that important. So for example, the idea of these deities that Buddhism have, the kind of traditional view of deities in Buddhism, to the degree which they believe in kind of celestial beings, is the traditional Buddhist view on them is to feel a little bit sorry for them. Because it's not so good to be a god or goddess. It's really second best to being human. And so, they don't tend to elevate them to such high status when you're actually in some ways better off being a human. Partly because it's in the human realm that you can get enlightened. So it's not essential to Buddhism to believe in these things. But what is essential? And what's essential is to believe in something or to understand something or see something that's something you can see directly for yourself. You don't have to rely on metaphysics, you don't have to rely on texts or teachers or tradition. You don't have to believe in something you can't see. And in fact, the Dharma is supposed to be verifiable here and now, something visible here and now. So the question is, how is it visible here and now? I would like to read a different passage that's similar to what I did 2 weeks ago, where the Buddha describes how it's visible here and now. When a person is impassioned with lust, overwhelmed and infatuated by lust, then he or she plans for sets up for his own harm, for the harm of others, and for the harm of both. And he experiences in his mind suffering and grief. He also behaves badly by bodily speech and mind, and he does not understand, as it really is, his own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. But when lust has been abandoned, he neither plans for his own harm, nor the harm of others, nor the harm of both, and he does not experience in his mind suffering and grief. He will not behave badly by body, speech, and mind, and he will understand, as it really is, his own good, the good of others, and the good of both. In this way, Brahman, the Dharma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, and to be personally experienced by the wise. So in terms of lust, you know, very strong greed for desire for something, that's something we can experience directly. You don't have to believe in something metaphysical, to believe in lust this kind of way, strong craving and grasping. And it's not, you don't have to go very far to see the kind of harm that acting on lust can create in our world, and how it can cause harm from oneself and to others. And it's also possible to see that when we don't act on lust, that we avoid causing harm to us, ourselves and others. It can actually, by not having it, we're more likely to see what is helpful for us and what's beneficial for others. In seeing that, the Buddha said, we see the Dharma. So that's essential. And then it goes on and says the same thing about hatred and then about delusion. That both hatred and delusion, like lust, if you act on it, causes harm to oneself or to others or to both. And not acting on it allows one to avoid causing harm to self and other, and allows you to understand what is beneficial for self and other and both. Some people, hearing that as a definition of the Dharma, will be quite disappointed, because they would like to have something a little bit more lofty. They would like to have something that speaks to something great enlightenment and great realization, some great oneness, some great communion with God, or something. But the Buddha was very careful to avoid discussing the spiritual life from a point of view of something which is very hard to confirm or understand or believe, or which was slippery in terms of description and language, what's really going on. And what he focused on was something which was experiential, immediate, that everyone can see and share. And if we could see directly these forces of greed, hate, and delusion, how they work in our lives, and get wise about them, then it's possible to avoid avoid the problems that come with being in the grip of greed, hate, and delusion, lust, hatred, and delusion. And it's possible, by not being in the grip of them, to see more clearly what is beneficial for ourselves and to work for that benefit. The ultimate kind of good in Buddhism is freedom from any kind of clinging. And greed, hate, and delusion are called the roots of all clinging. Sometimes in Buddhism, the greed, hate, and delusion are called the three poisons. Sometimes they're called the three roots of unskillful behavior. Sometimes they're called the three afflictions. That when we're caught up in lust or greed, hatred, and delusion, that they afflict us, they cause harm. When we're not caught up in those, then there's a kind of a peace, an ease, a sense of well-being that comes, that maybe it's hard to really understand until we understand how deeply entrenched a clinging can be, how deeply entrenched and sometimes subtle the movements of greed, hatred, and delusion are. So to see these things is to see the Dharma. So delusion. So delusion in Buddhism is is similar to, I think, what we understand here in the West, but it's not necessarily so deeply entrenched that we can't see it operating. And one of the functions of meditation practice or mindfulness practice is to help us to see the erroneous ways in which we think, perceive, interpret the life we have. And one of the great things that can happen with meditation, if your mind gets quiet enough in meditation practice, quiet enough so that you see spaces between your thoughts, then you can see very clearly the arising of a thought. When you see the arising of a thought, an idea, an interpretation, a bias, a discrimination, a fantasy, then you can start questioning, is this true or not? If you just kind of go about the busy life and let your thinking just churn away freely, many people can't really separate themselves out from their thinking, and they believe what they think. Or they're so embedded in their thinking that they see their world through their thoughts without realizing the interpretation that thinking is making for what we see. So if you're walking down the street and you see someone walking towards you who looks, is really big, you know, and muscular, and perhaps wearing kind of, you know, clothes of particular type of clothes, I don't know what that would be, and you, if you're quiet enough or mindful enough, you could watch the thought arise in your mind. Oh, this looks like danger. If you can watch that thought arise, then you know, in a sense, it's just a thought. It might not be what's really out there. Let's be careful that I don't project that thought onto that person. Let me be careful not to see that person through that thought. But if I'm not mindful, it's very easy just to kind of believe that the thought is accurate. This, the person actually is the way we think they are. A tremendous amount of prejudice in our society, discrimination, prejudice, harm that people do to each other, begins with a thought that we have interpreting or assigning ideas to who the other people are. And most of them are sometimes delusions, or they're false interpretations of who people are. Sometimes they're, even if they're accurate to some degree, sometimes we can see people only through that lens. And that's kind of a delusion, to see people only through one lens. Someone causes me harm once, they lied to me or something, and now every time I see them, I think they're just a liar. But I'm sure there's a lot of other qualities and ways that they could be in the world. So when you can be mindful enough to watch the arising of a thought, you can question it. And not only can you question it, but sometimes there can be you can have the wisdom to see, I don't think that thought's necessarily accurate. In fact, I know it's not accurate. We can have a lot of thoughts about ourselves that the same way, there can be a lot of interpretations about ourselves. We can see the arising of a thought that says something like, I'm no good, I'm lousy, or I'm the best, or people should treat me this way, or people are not treating me properly. And you see the arising of that thought, and you can question it, or sometimes you can see clearly, you know, that's not necessarily true. It's not needed, that kind of thought. It's a kind of delusion to believe that way. Some ways that the thoughts operate is by assigning the idea that things are permanent, that are not permanent, that are impermanent. This is the way it is. There's a delusion of permanence which can operate. It's one of the very classic delusions that Buddhism talks about. We don't necessarily actively think about this, but we're operating through our thinking, through our interpretation of it, as if this is it. It's always going to be this way. So the story that I like to tell of when we had my young son was a very difficult period in his life for us. He was like, I don't know, 2 or something, and a high-need kind of kid. And he was one of those days where he was just really, it was hard. And And he was there on the floor somehow, and my wife and I were there, and she looked up at me, and she looked at me, and she said, "Gil, we're having one of those kinds of days." And that kind of popped the bubble, the delusion of permanence for me. I was operating as if this is it. This is the way it's always going to be. I mean, if you'd asked me, "Do you believe it's always going to be this way?" I would have said, "No, of course not." But, you know, I wasn't thinking so clearly. I needed to have a wife, a spouse, who would say, "You know, Gil, it's just one of those kinds of days. You're having one of those kinds of days. This is, you know..." And that kind of broke it for me. So, "Oh, I can manage a day like this. That's okay." It was somehow the idea that, "Oh, this is forever." That was the challenge. And so how many of our problems, difficulties in life, do we kind of add this layer of interpretation? This is why it's always going to be. Or how many of the wonderful things that happen in our life do we put the layer, "This is always going to be"? So when I was 20, I spent a summer sailing across the Atlantic. And it was a very ecstatic summer. It was a wonderful thing. It was beautiful. It was actually a beautiful sailing trip across the Atlantic in nature and very harmonious and for the most part. And I got really high from this. And then I moved to a new city. I dropped out of college, which you were almost supposed to do back then. You know, it was kind of like not so unusual. And so I moved to a new city. I'd never been before. And I remember meeting someone, soon after I arrived, and I said, "I'll never be depressed again." Because I was so high from the trip, you know. That's it. You know, that's it. I got it made now. And that fall, I was the most depressed I'd ever been in my life. Kind of like went up, and then I went crashed. But there was the delusion of permanence. "I'll never be depressed. And this, you know, I'll always be happy now. I got it made." So, you know, we overlay this interpretation. Another interpretation or idea of delusion that we overlay in our experience, that Buddhism puts great emphasis to kind of pop the bubble of, is the idea of permanent self. That there is a permanent abiding identity of who you really are. So, so you can see it, you know. So some people's identity is closely tied to needing it to be a certain way. And things, self doesn't stay, nothing stays the same. So the idea or the hope or the expectation that my body will always stay the same. You know, and who I really am is my youthful body. And then the body changes. And so our health changes. And then if our identity is tied to a particular way of having a self around the body, then we suffer because we've attached to a certain idea of how the self has to be. We can have certain ideas of self around a whole array of emotions and feelings, around intentions and desires, around plans, around personality changes, about how other people see us. They can build up a self around a profession and a job. This is who I really am, is I'm really a, whatever your profession might be, your career might be. And then we lose the job, and the people who lost their job or retired, and they kind of lose themselves. They don't know who they are. It's very confusing because their whole identity has been tied to the career. Or identities can be tied to being a, a parent. There's some people who are very closely embedded, entrenched to being like a mother or a father. And that's their identities around them. And it's very hard to change that identity, for example, when the kids grow up and leave home. And they still kind of have to find themselves that way. So there's a whole array of ways in which people assign self to what is best not taken as the permanent, abiding, true self of who you really are. And so in Buddhism, we emphasize not seeing self as something essential, but rather a role that we pick up and put down. So it's fine to be a parent, a mother, a father. It's fine to be, you know, a baker or a doctor or a carpenter or whatever role a person might have. The role is fine. The role comes with certain behaviors that are expected. But you don't have to kind of define who you really are by the role. And in fact, what Buddhism points to is the value of being quite fluid in picking up and putting down roles, so that you pick them up and put them down. So when they're appropriate, you pick them up. When they're not appropriate, you put them down. So the delusion of taking what's not self, what's not the true and abiding self, that a delusion can cause a lot of suffering. But it's possible to watch that delusion arise. It's possible to watch the building up of self, the creation of self. If you can watch, if you're quiet enough or mindful enough to watch these thoughts arise. So I remember once watching my delusions of grandeur arise. You know, that's silly. I thought, that's silly. But then it arose again. It's a fantasy. I had this fantasy of, I had been practicing in Japan, in monasteries there, and I heard about these, in Mount Hiei, there's a mountain, a sacred mountain in Japan, there's a monastery, where the monks there do this marathon running. They run around the mountain, like, every day, and they do run around, they do bows, and they have tremendously fit. They run around, bow, chant, do all those things, and they get up like early in the morning, like 1 o'clock in the morning, and do all this running, and they're really fit. And I thought, oh, so I was flying back to America on the airplane after a year in Japan, and I thought, oh, when I get back to America, I'm going to get up every morning at 1 o'clock, you know, and I'll be this great spiritual practitioner. I mean, before anyone else wakes up, I'll have done all this kind of running and bowing and chanting, and I'll be so great, you know. And I kind of watched myself have these thoughts. And say, where are these thoughts coming from? You know, why am I caught up in those kinds of thoughts? And why am I defining myself this way and wanting to see that? This is just delusion. Delusions of grandeur, delusion of something. And I could see it as being delusive. I think some people have delusions like that and they don't see it as delusion. They think this is what they need to, who they need to be and what they need to do. So to see, to create a self, to have delusions about self, is one of the delusions. To be deluded about what, think that what's not self is self. The third kind of delusion, which is kind of interesting, is to see what is suffering as not suffering. To see what is stressful as not stressful. So sometimes we can do activities that in and of themselves are not that pleasant to do, but the overlay of interpretations and stories and expectations we have around those activities offer the promise, if you do this, you're going to be happy. If you do this, something wonderful is going to happen to you. We look for happiness in places in which their happiness is not found. We look for freedom from suffering in the suffering itself. So what's an example for that? Since I can't come up with an example, can someone give me an example?
Hard work.
Hard work can be... So you have to say more, because I've done hard work, and it's interesting...
Excessive work.
Okay. Something else.
A big house.
So thinking that if you have the big house, only then can you be happy.
Okay.
So then
you cling to it.
So spend all this time working hard, really making the money. It's a real drag. You work 60 hours, 80 hours a week to make the money and struggle, and you get the house and you get the mortgage payment, and you finally have this big house, and then you have to keep it up, and you have to clean it, and you have to take care of it, and then you have a mortgage payment, and then you have to work more, and then the house is probably not quite big enough, because...
And there's a bigger house.
Then there's probably a bigger house. Okay. So what else?
30 years of marital counseling.
There was an easier solution 30 years ago. What else?
Yes. I was thinking all you have to do is turn on the TV and find examples of if you just have this ice cream or that particular kind of rum or, you know, 100, you know, whatever's on the TV for the night, the advertisements all promise that, and so many people buy into it.
I hardly watch any television at all, but there are times when a few times I've watched television where I thought it was, you know, I watched because I was going to thought I was going to enjoy it. and I kind of did, but I noticed at the end of the hour, an hour and a half, whatever I was watching, I actually felt kind of yucky. Something
said. If you got that special toothpaste.
I see. The problem with me when I watch television is I mute the commercials. So that's I guess that's my fault. If now I'll know next time. Maybe I'll only watch the commercials next time. So what are other examples of things that people think is that are suffering, that are stressful, that we think are going to promise happiness, but don't?
The perfect mate.
The perfect mate, your mate sitting next to you. So the perfect mate. And always searching for the perfect mate and not really paying careful attention to the one you're with. Appreciating the one you're with. Yes?
Having a full life, always on the go, no downtime, no empty spaces.
So too many good things sometimes is suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, we're always on the go. Yes? Avoiding conflict in a relationship. Yes, conflict is painful. So if you want to be happy, you should really avoid them, and like the plague, because everyone will be happy if you don't, you know, if you don't talk about the conflict or the difficulty. So you tiptoe around, you're silent, you ignore, what else do? You pretend it's not there, you acquiesce, you give in, all kinds of things. Whereas, in fact, if you engage in the conflict, it might be unpleasant, but you engage in the conflict, that's where maybe some resolution can happen and some different change in behavior can be. I saw with my son was really young. Maybe some of you parents have seen this. It was really important to set limits for him. It seemed like, you know, he was an expert in wanting to find out how far, you know, he could go before we set the limits. That's what it's, you know, I guess that's what people want to do, is find out, right? And so, you know, we would let him do things, and then at some point we would say, no, no more. And he would be so upset. I mean, he would look like, you know, I'd done the work, you know, if the Child Protection Services had, you know, happened to walk into the house just after I said, you can't do that. They would have thought I had done something really, really bad to this kid. All I said was no. You know, you can't do that. Just stop. And but that kind of temper tantrum that he had, I was really upset, but amazingly would last about 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And after that, he was so much happier than he was before. It was like somehow knowing what those limits are kind of made him feel safe, and then he could relax and be happy again. So delusion and ignorance in Buddhism are closely connected. It has to do with this ignorance about where happiness is found and the nature of suffering. It's said in Buddhism that the key ignorance that people have to overcome if they want to be really happy or live at peace is the ignorance that ignores suffering and the cause of suffering. So we have suffering. It's said in Buddhism that suffering arises from our clinging. or the suffering that Buddhism wants to address is the suffering that arises from clinging. And so that suffering, to address it, you have to understand the clinging itself. And if we're ignorant about the nature of suffering, then we can't address it. And that's a fundamental ignorance that Buddhism tries to overcome. And I've talked to someone today who has for many, many decades, since childhood, has been suffering deeply in pain. But the pain is directed outwards. And has spent an amazing amount of time being angry and critical at others. You're very quick to take offense and then attack other people, be angry at other people, or push other people away and resist. And there's a kind of ignorance then. It's ignoring our own pain by directing the aversion or the resistance outward. And so this can go on, it can be so embedded in how a person functions in the world, it almost becomes part of their personality. So Buddhism requires us to stop that kind of delusion or that ignorance and stop and be willing to turn around and look and be present for suffering and the causes of suffering. So just as a woman said that avoiding conflict with others is a way of, you know, thinking that we can be happy if we avoid conflict, we can also avoid conflict in ourselves. We can avoid the stresses, the clinging, the suffering in ourselves, thinking if we ignore it or if we direct it outward or just fix it in some external way, we'll be happy. So the focus on Buddhism, again, is one of the reasons why mindfulness is so important, is that Buddhism doesn't offer, it's not a metaphysical religion, or it doesn't offer supernatural beliefs. It doesn't offer a promise of something which cannot be experienced in this lifetime, here and now. It's not a promise of what's going to happen in future lifetimes. It has something that you can see and experience for yourself. It doesn't require great mystical insights or experiences. You don't have to be a mystic. You don't have to have great dramatic experiences of bliss and white light. It requires us to really see honestly and directly something that's accessible to human beings, something that's really kind of in some ways ordinary. But it requires cultivating mindfulness, being mindful, attentive, to clearly, very sensitive with our noticing, our attention. So sensitive that, and attentive, well, sensitive and attentive, and at the same time calm enough that we can see what arises, what bubbles up inside of us. There's no magic solution in Buddhism. There's not like this magic key of, if only I get that enlightenment experience, I push that enlightenment button, I'll be happy ever after. It really requires us to do some inner practice. It requires us to practice. And it requires us to practice with something which is ordinary. Suffering, clinging, looking at greed, desire, lusting, looking at aversion, hostility, ill will, hate, the large and the very subtle manifestations of being for and against, and delusion, looking at delusion. And what I found, at least, is the way to work with delusion is to have the mind calm enough and mindful enough to see the arising of a belief, of a thought, of interpretation. And to see it arise very clearly before it gets into a whole big complex picture, idea, philosophy of what's what. And when the mind is calm enough and mindful enough, it's amazing how you can watch the building blocks of our worldview, building blocks of our conception of self, building blocks of our conception and understanding of other people and who we think other people are, the building blocks of beliefs and ideas about what we think reality and life is all about. And if you have that sensitivity to watch the arising of it and to question it, chances are you'll have the wisdom to differentiate between what is an accurate interpretation, a meaningful interpretation of reality, and what has no real authority for that belief. There's no real basis for these kinds of beliefs that we carry. And once you start seeing there's no basis for some of the beliefs you have, then you can begin wondering how useful it is to hold a belief and to operate through a belief that has no authority or validity or basis for believing that. Even if I want to believe it, even I'd like to believe it, you know, the fact that there's no basis upon which to believe that, is it useful, is it valuable for me to believe that? This can be very, very challenging. Because certainly challenging to do practice, but more challenging than simply being mindful enough to see the arising of belief structures. It's very challenging to begin letting them go. It's very challenging to be willing to question them, because sometimes the very foundation of how we live our life and orient ourselves is built on belief structures. And if your belief structure is built on Zeus, and you see Zeus thoughts arise, and you say, wait a minute, how do I know that Zeus really exists? How can I really know that? What tells me that Zeus exists? And then you say, well, it's a book. A book, you know? How does that, is that book really? What authority does that book come from? Or where that person tells it? Or you know, whatever. But if your whole life was based on Zeus, it can be very, you know, very uncomfortable. And sometimes it takes a lot of courage to hang in there and keep questioning and looking and exploring and wrestling with these beliefs that we have. And maybe in the end you'll come to a much greater understanding of what you do believe in, but maybe also you'll be able to put to rest a lot of the beliefs which are not needed. And finally, what Buddhism teaches is that your profound and very meaningful level of peace, of happiness, of love, of compassion, does not require a lot of believing. It doesn't require having a worldview of a lot of different things. In fact, the simpler and simpler your worldview is, the simpler your belief structure is, the more you let go of complicated ideas and are really present in a clear and full way, and be able to see the arising and passing of their mental functioning, the heart functions and what goes on, you'll find that happiness, peace, and love is something that's really easy. It doesn't require much at all. It comes perhaps from a radical simplicity of being more than from beliefs and religions and such things. And so hopefully we can live our life free of delusion. So I hope that helped with around delusion, since that's people are perplexed by it. And if not, then my apologies for putting you through the evening. And as you go about this week, you might get curious about, see if you can notice the arising of a thought. When it first arises, a belief, an idea about something. It's like when you start, to, when the first time, like when you see, when you notice the first thought you have about a particular person, this, you know, on a particular day. See if you can notice the first thought about that person. And then see what the nature of that thought is. And see if it's, you know, if you really study the arising of a thought or a belief or interpretation, see if you can pop the bubble of some of the interpretations which may not be accurate that you're living with. Okay, so thank you.